tying up my white tie, brushing off my tail.
Fred Astaire from Top Hat. One of his best movies, Next Level Tap Dancing. Harking back to that elegant era where white tie meant you were going somewhere very special and black tie meant you didn't swan along in jeans and a hoodie. Ties are still worn in society, regular ties, but as we know, not as much. They still mean a lot, though, as Stephen Fry found when he started posting on Instagram about his vast collection of ties to tens of thousands of people. And the book that has emerged from those conversations is called Fry's Ties, The Surprising and Colourful History of Neckwear. And he needs a little introduction to us or anyone in the English-speaking world, really. He was down here for a while once shooting The Hobbit, loving our country, complaining about our broadband. And he is, of course, a great man of letters, of television, of film, and of style. Stephen Fry, lovely to have you on. How are you?
I'm fine, Jim. Nice to speak to you across half the world.
We haven't talked to you in a while, not since you brought out your book Mythos about the Greek myths retold.
Yes, you make me feel rather cheap. The only time I bother to talk to you is when I've got something to sell, when I'm sort of on the street corner swinging my handbag.
Speaking of happenstance, you rather relished the caprice of the Greek gods, you know, extinguishing or determining human life and fortune with the flick of a finger. In this pandemic world, do you see great vicissitudes persisting across the planet? You know, our fates cast to the winds again in any sort of way reminiscent of mythological uncertainties, Stephen?
It's certainly, I think, Jim, as good a way of looking at how things have panned out as any other. There's no possibility of using a kind of rational historical timeline in order to determine cause and effect because it's so muddied. It's like trying to unstir a cloudy, muddy lake and get the mud to settle back at the bottom in the same order it began. Do you know what I mean? It's just, you almost might as well look at what happens as random or produced by capricious gods. And we can't help thinking of it as a sort of punishment. Sometimes we're quite accurate. You could say it's a punishment for not being careful enough. You could say, if you were, you know, theologically inclined, it was a punishment for our greed and consumerism. I think the important thing is perhaps that's what the classical masters taught us more than anything else, that the Senecas and Marcus Aurelius, people like that, is what is outside of our control is a waste of time trying to alter. I mean, it's so obvious when you say it like that. Who could disagree? If it's outside your control, by definition, you can't control it. And yet, if we look at ourselves, all of us spend an inordinate amount of time getting furious and upset and unhappy and all colours of emotion, trying to change things that we never could change and that are nothing to do with us. It's like King Lear shaking his fist at the weather. It's futile and it's also rather beautiful. It's part of the arrogance of humanity that we kind of solipsistically believe that we can alter the way things, we can change the direction of spin of the world somehow. And I'm certainly not arguing that we should all sort of sit back passively and just let everything wash over us. There's coping, there's management, there's, you know, finding ways through when but you're right, this whole lockdown has been most strange. And I suppose to come to our business here today, one of the things I did was sort of clear out the house in, you know, spring clean. And it literally was spring for us. March is a spring in the Northern Hemisphere, of course. And it was a beautiful spring. It was one of the most beautiful anyone can remember. The sky was constantly blue. The birds, everyone was suddenly aware of bird life, which, of course, in New Zealand is a huge thing too, I know. And also just, as I say, spring cleaning. And I opened a few drawers and found they were packed with old ties that I hadn't looked at for decades, probably. And I thought, well, I'll sort these out. And as I picked them up, I would give a sort of cry of recognition. It was almost like recognizing a friend. And you can't quite do that with a jacket or a pair of trousers. Yes, you can remember when you last wore them, perhaps, or wonder why you're so much fatter now that you can't get into them. But a tie, you'd have to be quite extraordinarily obese not to be able to wear an old tie. So I took one, and it was a green one made by Fashionable, the French fashion house, means fashionable in French in a kind of way, although à la mode is more usual. And I wrote a little paragraph or so about the house Fashionable, because I remembered that Cary Grant had been the one who made it fashionable, and I also recalled how popular they'd been during the 80s, which is when I bought it. And I posted it and gave it a hashtag, thinking I'll do the same tomorrow. Fries ties, I thought. Rolls off the tongue. Yes. And the next day I did a very different sort of tie. And then each day I would present a tie. And I was amazed at the well of memories that each one of them offered me to, you know, I don't like dipping down into this extraordinary personal and social and cultural and fashion and retail history was kind of alive in these things. Some of them silk and grand. There was one, I was in the 80s, I was walking down Madison Avenue in New York, a city I'd lately fallen in love with. I was lucky enough to have a musical running there. And I, as I was going down Madison Avenue, I saw Andy Warhol. And my heart kind of leapt. I'm lucky enough to have met quite a few well-known people, but Andy Warhol was somehow a new kind of class of, whoa, Andy Warhol. And he looked so Andy Warhol, pencil thin with white bleached hair and a strange kind of thing and those sunken cheekbones. And he had a posse of two or three with him. So I did a very naughty thing and followed him. And he turned into a store. It was the Versace, the Gianni Versace store, the flagship one in Madison Avenue, which is where most of the big fashion shops are. And so I went in after him, and I saw him and his people kind of embracing the manager or whoever it was. It might have been a Versace, for all I know. And they looked very at home with each other, and there was a sipping, espressos with a twist of lemon, as was very fashionable in those days. And I peeped at them from behind a tie carousel. And suddenly someone came up to me and went, yes. And I panicked and grabbed the first tie I could see and said, I'll take this. And it was like $250 or something, which was a lot of money back then. And so whenever I look at that tie, that comes back.
Actually, a lot of the designer famous names are in here. But New Zealand's Robert Charles has a tie in Pride of Place and a very nice pink one. It is, Stephen.
It is. It's a beauty. And I was delighted that there was a Kiwi designer in there. And Robert Charles is very, very fine. And it's one of my favourite ties, actually. Yes, Robert Charles. Great name.
Fry's Ties, it struck me, is an easier title to come up with than Moab is My Washpot, which was your autobiography.
I still get people saying, what the heck? And I say, isn't it obvious? I can't recall, Jim, why. I sort of can recall why I called it that. It was because it was a memoir of my schooling. I was sent away to boarding school at a very young age, seven, hundreds of miles from home, and which I'm not asking for sympathy. It was, when you're seven, and you're sent away to school, you don't question it because, your brother was sent away at the same age, your parents were when they were my age, and, of course, everyone at the school is my age. So you just think, that's what happens. I was homesick, of course. But anyway, that was my school days, and it was a time of biblical quotations and hymns and things like that. And the school had there was a boot room called Edom, and that's where you had your football boots and things like that were kept. And the muddy boots was called Edom. And the shower room and the changing room for sports and things was called Moab. And that's because there's a quotation in the Bible, Moab is my washpot, and over Edom shall I cast out my shoe. it's a rather bizarre. It's one of those Old Testament verses that washes over most people. This yeah. It's like the begat, so, and you know, Jeroboam begat, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And so it just, as a phrase, reminded me of the peculiarity of English education, the strangeness of it all. And I thought it was an arresting name, if nothing else.
There is a great strangeness to it. Well, Fry's Pies is lovely, and Fry's Ties. Fry's Pies.
Should be Fry's Pies. You've just given me a great idea. I shall write a cookery book of pork pies, apple pies, cherry pies. Oh, brilliant. Jim, I'll have to thank you on the dedication page.
I'll have 10%, thank you. You've got some you've got some wonderful ties. You've got pandas and pigs. There's I don't think the tie with a cheetah on it makes it into the book, or the Bugs Bunny, but you've got so many. So you pick them up on a whim whenever you travel, and do you need a story to go with the tie to buy it, or just because you like it?
The fact that I am somewhere new makes it a kind of story in a way. So if I'm in, I don't know where it might be, for example, if you're in New Orleans, they have this very appealing tradition of the lagniap. I don't know if you've ever been to Louisiana.
No.
Lagniap is spelled LAGNIAPPE, lagniap, but pronounced lagniap. And it means a gift with purchase, I think is how they say it in department stores. In other words, if you buy a book, if it's above a certain sort of price, they'll give you a smaller book as a present, a lagniap, a little tip. And so I remember buying a tie and getting a small bow tie as the lagniap. And the reason I said it was appealing was because of my peculiar brain, is that I noticed that the word lagniap is an anagram of appealing, which is just one of those odd things that my brain does. I'm sure many of your listeners have similarly peculiar brains.
Yeah. Even in the Moab is my washpot days, you were buying ties. I was reading by the time you were 15, you owned more than 40.
Yes, that's right. My grandfather's died. The second grandfather to die was when I was about 10, and a great uncle died that year as well, I think. And they each, you know, my father was an only child, and so he sort of received all the things that they left, you know, all their property. Amongst them, which he sort of gave to me and my brother, were collar boxes, which were these leather, round leather boxes that smelt of camphor and tobacco and manly smells, which contained collars, stiff starched collars, wing collars, imperial collars, and normal collars, because they were of a generation who, when they wore a shirt, the collar was separate. It was a starched separate thing that was attached with a collar stud at the front and another stud at the back, two different styles. And inside the middle of the collar box was a little pot where you kept your studs. And I became obsessed. My favorite reading was, Sherlock Holmes and P.G. Woodhouse and John Buchan and Alfred Yates and all these sort of writers of the early 20th, late 19th century. And so I liked the idea of being like them, of dressing like them. And there were ties that came with these leather boxes of satin and silk ties. So I had quite a collection, and I would buy for very small money in secondhand shops and charity shops. I'd buy other ties, and I would stalk up and down the city of Norwich, which is the closest city to where we lived. We were right in the country, but I could get into the city sometimes by bus, by sort of country coach. And what a sight I must have looked. I don't know. I'd wear a suit and occasionally tried to walk with a cane, but I lost the cane quite quickly. I even thought about a monocle, but eventually decided not to. I smoked once I was past the age of 15, and I used to smoke expensive and weird cigarettes, coloured cigarettes, Sobrani cocktail, they were called, or things like that. And, I mean, it was hopelessly pretentious and absurd. But, you know, growing up gay, at first not really knowing it, and feeling different, feeling attracted to an old-fashioned thing that was different from the sort of vaguely scruffy, long-haired, early 70s teenage look, which, in looking back, is marvellous. It's glam rock and all kinds of things. But I like the idea of, you know, looking like my grandfather's generation. There are always kids like that, and they're often teased and regarded as period and so on. But that was kind of what I bought into, that feel, that look. That was what was behind my wardrobe in Narnia terms, you know.
You also find out about, in this book, the people behind the wardrobes themselves. And this fascinated me, what three of the Beatles were wearing when they strolled across Abbey Road.
Yes, it's funny you should say that. I'm actually wearing a Tommy Nutter tie at the moment. He was a remarkable man, Tommy Nutter. He was born in the East End of London from a pretty poor family, but he very quickly, left school at a very young age and joined a tailor's in the East End and learned how to cut cloth. And he moved to Savile Row, which is the kind of the ne plus ultra, the absolute final destination for the handmade English gentleman's suit. All the aristocrats would have their suits made there. But also it was the 60s, and he gave Savile Row something new. He was to tailoring what David Bailey was to photography and Twiggy was to modelling. And in a sense, the Beatles were to music, of course. Almost above where he was doing his tailoring was the rooftop where the Beatles performed their famous rooftop concert, because it was in Savile Row that Apple Corps, their company, had their offices. Anyway, Tommy Nutter, yes, he designed the clothes that the Beatles wore for the famous Abbey Road cover, all except George Harrison, who insisted on denim. But the other three, crossing the zebra crossing on the way to the Abbey Road Studios, you will see they're in Tommy Nutter. And he made me the odd jacket and things. He was a lovely chap. And then a sad end that is one that all too many people I knew in the entertainment and fashion business came to in the late 80s, mid and late 80s, and that was he succumbed to HIV, died of AIDS-related illnesses. Mm. And so I look at this time, looking at it now, I've just taken it off because I'd forgotten I was wearing it. And it's a beautiful design. And on the back, it just says Tommy Nutter, Savile Row, London. And that's a memory. Goodness me, it is. He was a great loss.
And Peter Jackson, whom you know well, is about to present that big project about the Beatles' last hurrah.
Yes, Get Back. Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to see that. It's wonderful to see what he's done with this. I can imagine. I can't wait.
So clothes make the man, said Mark Twain, whom you quote at the start of your book. Naked people have little or no influence on society, which is lovely. I still laugh at that. Ties no longer, Stephen, ties no longer, though, bind a class of person. I mean, you would concede this at least in part because you say in the book ties are dead.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'd say it in a kind of they're dead in as much as in cool businesses, Silicon Valley and Hollywood and places like that. No one wears a tie. It would be considered weird. You know, that was the old, you know, when Apple did their famous Think Different adverts and then did TV commercials with John Hodgman, being the PC guy, he was in a grey suit with a tie, whereas Justin Long played the Apple guy and he was like cool in chinos and whatever and an open top to show that Apple are the cool place we're not Bill Gatesy, we're young and free and gorgeous and all the rest of it. And so that even the five-star hotels in London, your Claridge's and Savoy and Ritz's, those sort of hotels, had to stop having a rule that you have to wear a tie to get into the hotel, because then there wouldn't be Steven Spielberg wouldn't go in, Steve Jobs wouldn't go in, you know, or whatever, because in that sense, ties are dead. But the coding, funnily enough, the messages that ties send are still there. You know, especially perhaps in England, I can still instantly see, of course, an MCC tie, the Marylebone Cricket Club, which is the most marvellous place to join if you love cricket. It's got a 29-year waiting list to become a member of the MCC. So those of us who are members wear our ties with extreme pride on at Lord's, but it's rather bad form to wear it anywhere else. You wear it at Lord's Cricket Ground when there's a when you're in there. Or there are various gentlemen's clubs like the Garrick Club, for example, which I am a member of, and that tie is a sort of rather wonderful pale green and pink. It's known as the cucumber and salmon tie because it sort of roughly is those colours. And that again is you instantly see that go, a fellow Garrickian who will be likely an actor or maybe a journalist, a television presenter, that sort of thing, occasionally a lawyer. So there are those sort of things. And there are military ties, of course. You spot the Brigade of Guards ties, the Coldstream Guards, the very sort of classy household division of soldiers who guard the Queen, and that you spot those ties and you think, ah, I see. Or the Royal Artillery tie, or, you know, all kinds of ties. I remember seeing one once when which just had little parachutes, and I said to the chap, well, that's an interesting tie. And he said, airborne, and that's the airborne division of the army. It's very, very, you know, you have to be able to learn how to break people's necks to join that. So there are those sorts of ties, you know, that give off. Or there are work ties, actually, as well. When I was, between school and university and getting a job in what we call a gap year, I don't know if you use that phrase in New Zealand, but I remember getting a job at this department store in Norwich called Bonds. And it was, if you've ever seen that sitcom of the 70s, which I'm sure is unrepeatable these days, which was called Are You Being Served, which was very successful in its day. Hugely popular around the world. And I know it was popular in New Zealand as well. But there, if you remember, that the grander ones wore ties and carnations in their buttonhole and suits, and they were the floor walkers. And when I first joined, I was just, in a household, selling scrubbing brushes and kitchen utensils and things like that. But they moved me up to the top of the building because I think they were a bit snobbish and liked my accent. And so they thought I would be a good salesman in furniture. So I had to wear a suit. And the symbol of the shop, Bonds, was a bee. So I have this bumblebee tie that I used to have to wear at Bonds. And I and my fellow floor-walking furniture salesman, Mr. Ellis, we called each other Mr. Ellis and Mr. Fry, even though I was 17, you know. And we would try and speak in these ridiculously pompous ways to customers. Sir has announced himself as the most tasteful man in the shop. You have instinctively been drawn to the finest table in Norfolk. Congratulations. And they would startle. They would sort of leap back. and I'd say, the question, sir, should be asking is not, can I afford to buy this table, but can I afford not to own this table, you know, and all that sort of nonsense. But it passed. It made the day pass quickly and amusingly. And we did sell a few tables and chairs along the way. So, again, I look at that table, and that's a reminder of all kinds of things.
There are men who look really good in a tie. Well, I suppose I should really say a suit, but a suit with a tie, you know, like Daniel Craig and those sorts of people. I'm not one of those, alas. You can get away with it because you're Stephen Fry. You can wear what you like. But basically, is it genetic? Is it just anatomy dressing up in this way that, or what is it?
I think it's the confidence with which you wear it. I mean, I don't mean you should actually sort of stick your chest out and look cocky. I think it's, you know, the point is, if you are interested in colour and form and design and pattern and texture and so on, you can't go that far with a jacket or trousers, or you'll look like a rock star, you know, look like Elton John about to go on stage if you wore really patterned jackets and trousers. But that tiny piece of triangular real estate on your chest down to your stomach is an area where you really can experiment with that sort of form and so on. And you can have animals and silly things, or you can be just ordinary and dull and stripy. And there's another code, by the way, in Britain, and I suspect probably therefore in New Zealand and Australia and other countries that have a sort of long association with the United Kingdom. The stripes in a striped tie go from the top left, from the left shoulder to the right hip. But in America, most striped ties go from the right shoulder to the left hip. So that's something to look out for, little thing you can spot.
There are lots of little things you spot. And there are lots of knots in this book. The Prince Albert knot, I'd never heard of that.
Yes.
I'd never. And what knot do you use?
I usually use a four in hand, which is the most traditional, usual one, or very often the half Windsor, not the full Windsor, but the half Windsor. Though, funnily enough, you mentioned Daniel Craig. I remember as a boy reading falling in love with the James Bond books. I'd seen the films, of course, everybody had. My brother and I would go and see them whenever they came out. But I suddenly discovered that the books were really different and quite extraordinarily well written, as they are. They really are well worth going to. I mean, yes, he's brutal and snobbish and cruel and all the rest of it, and a lot of it is perhaps unacceptable to modern sensibilities. But if you have the imagination to overlook that and forgive it for its time, I think there's a lot of richness in there. But I do remember at one point, and this was very typical of Ian Fleming, he said, Bond never trusted anybody who tied their tie in a Windsor knot or wore suede shoes. I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I remember that. At the time, I didn't know what a Windsor knot was. And obviously, it's presumably some member of the royal family once tied their tie that way. It's a few more wrap rounds. You have to wear it really with a waistcoat because it shortens the tie because it does an extra journey round. And I also remember Bond going into Jermyn Street in London in St. James's, very near where I live, in fact, in town. And he went and he bought a black silk knitted tie on top of a Sea Island cotton polo shirt, black one. And Sean Connery exactly imitated that in, I think, the first film, Dr. No. It may have been in the second, which is, I think, From Russia with Love. But anyway, I remember when I was old enough and could afford it, I was probably 18 or something, maybe even older, going to New and Lingwood, a fine shop in Jermyn Street, and getting exactly that rig out because I so wanted to look like Bond. Quite absurd. I've got as much chance of looking like Bond as I have looking like Mike Tyson. There you go.
You have knitted ties in here, and I know you're a fan of knitted ties, and they look attractive. Are they generally accepted?
Yeah. Yes, I think they are. I mean, slightly more likely to be in the country at a race meeting or something like that, perhaps. But these days, I think, yeah, I don't think that the kind of snobbery that Ian Fleming gave us with not trusting a Windsor knot or whatever. I think, yeah, I mean, in fact, they are Huntsman. I think two or three of them are from Huntsman, which is just about the most ritzy and aristocratic of the Savile Row tailoring shops. So I think they must be acceptable for that reason.
There is the theory that a suit and tie, and I know you by no means wear just suits with your ties, but a suit and tie has become a uniform for the powerless. The Vox website says suits tend now to be worn by those impelled to do so. The power dressing is very casual now. What do you
think? I think that's right. I think you're right, Jim. I think the wolves of Wall Street, the really powerful ones, don't wear ties because they can afford not to. They can imitate Steve Jobs and wear turtlenecks, or they can just be, you know, loose at the collar because they are the boss. Whereas the poor slave has a tie, and the tie is a symbol of the being in fee to, you know, being a serf almost. And I think if that is the case, if you wear a tie because you just have to and you feel, then for goodness sake, make it a stylish one. You know, make it a statement, make it a kind of an FU tie, if I can put it that way. You know, a tie that says, yeah, I'm wearing a tie, but I'm wearing this tie, which says me. It doesn't say my boss or my company.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I think women should wear ties too, by the way. I think they look great in ties. Obviously, they don't always have the kind of top that can manage it, but, you know.
I came across something, just very, very finally, I came across something you said about the novelist E.M. Forster, who wrote A Passage to India. And you said, Forster writes about the beast and the monk in us all. Only connect and both will be exalted. And that reminds me of something Elton John once said, that he actually wrote hymns as his best songs. Did ties begin to connect you in some strange way with more exalted realms after that very misspent youth of yours?
Maybe they do, Jim. That's an extraordinary question and a very interesting one. I mean, I think what Forster was saying was, in a way, it was a little like what Nietzsche said in his famous, he adduced the Greek mythological gods Apollo and Dionysus to describe two sides of humanity. Apollo, the harmonious, ordered side, the side that is the god, he's the god of prophecy, but also the god of mathematics and the god of oratory and rhetoric and reason. And that is part of what it is to be human, to have that But it's also part of human to be Dionysus, the god of wine and frenzy and addiction and instinct and impulse. And a tie, of course, on the one hand, can be Apollonian. It's very neat, it's ordered, it stops your collar from flying about, and it shows that you're inside society. But if it's riotous enough, if it's original enough, if it's surprising, then it taps into the Dionysian in us as well. So we only connect those two sides of us. And yes, both shall be exalted.
Nice to talk to you as always. Well done on the book, and thanks for giving us the chat.
Thank you, Jim, and I'm sorry it had to end.